And thank Representative Barker for embarrassing the rest of us who are not dressed up in his tuxedo today. No. Representative Barker's birthday is today, so he's all dressed up and looking good. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2003 called Bill Geary. I believe he had some things that he wanted to say, and he was, I'm sure, working last week and unable to come during spring break. So I thought I'd make the opportunity available to you this week.
Thank you. Snow still on the ground in upstate New York. The last time I appeared before you, Representative Nolan asked me to comment on the Legislative Council opinion dated March 11, 2003, which deals with House Bill 2003 and 2004, and I was chagrined at the time to say I hadn't had an opportunity to see the opinion and had to take off on responding to those questions. I have since had an opportunity to review Legislative Council's opinion and have submitted a detailed response by letter dated March 26, 2003 to the members of the committee. I don't plan to go into detail in the point-by-point response that's included in my letter. I'm, of course, happy to answer any questions that you may have. Mm-hmm. What I thought might be useful, though, was to just take a minute before I respond to your questions to kind of look at the big picture of what is involved here. I know the committee is painfully aware of the economic issues that confront us because of the public employees retirement system costs, and the corresponding fact that some, although certainly not all, IRS members are or will be receiving benefits far in excess of what anybody ever reasonably anticipated. At the same time, as I have acknowledged before, there are we're dealing in an area where certain legislative acts in the past have created contractual rights on the part of PERS members. And so any attempt to craft a reform of the system that will reduce the cost and correspondingly rein in projected future benefits has to be undertaken with acute knowledge of the contract rights of the members in an attempt to accommodate those rights as we craft a reform. And I would be kidding if I said that this was not a daunting task. It's daunting both because it constrains to a significant degree the latitude that this body has in crafting solutions, and also because, to a certain extent, what is permissible and what is not permissible is fundamentally unknowable until the court tells us. And that's the context in which we have been working in attempting to present to you solutions to the problem, and one of which, of course, is House Bill 2003. We have tried in drafting the bill to be mindful of the contract rights of members, and in the process, we have taken a few more twists and turns in finding the solution than one might if you were just trying to go in the most direct way from the problem to the solution, and that's in an effort to recognize and be protective of the contract rights of PERS members. Now, in this context, when I'm told that an attorney, particularly legislative counsel, has expressed an opinion concerning contract rights and the impact that a bill or multiple bills may have on contract rights, I'm interested in knowing what that opinion is, not only because I want to have an opportunity to respond to it, but because this is truly a learning process, and I want to have as much information as we can have to know whether there's a way better to craft the solution so that there is a greater likelihood that we will withstand the inevitable challenge that will come to whatever this body chooses to do. In that regard, I must say that the Legislative Council opinion offers almost no help, not because it's wrong, although, as I've explained in my letter, I think in significant ways it is, but because the opinion really offers no analysis of why Legislative Council reached the conclusion that he did. And in the world that I live in, it's really true that opinions are like noses. Everybody has one. And to stretch the analogy even a little bit further among lawyers, noses tend to run on and on. But it isn't really very helpful to just count the noses in an exercise like this. It's the quality of the reasoning that leads to the conclusions that is informative. And the opinion, being in summary form as it is, doesn't provide much help in that regard. There are, I think, two fundamental views that you've heard espoused before you, one by myself and one primarily by Mr. Hartman on behalf of the PERS Coalition. The PERS Coalition will tell you that anything that this body does that has the effect of reducing projected future retirement benefits is a breach of contract. That is what I think of as a kind of an absolutist view of contract rights. And I think, although I can't be 100% certain, that Legislative Council is in that same camp. That is, basically, you can't do anything. We, on the other hand, have suggested to you that gleaning what we can from the decisions of the Supreme Court, statutory contract analysis is far more intricate and much more individualized than that. When one makes a claim that actions of this body would breach or impair a statutory contract, the first question has to be, what is the contract? And in every instance that the court has dealt with contractual promises, whether in the context of legislative contracts in other contexts or in the context of retirement plans, it has always looked to the statutes to find the promise. And it isn't enough merely to be able to point to a promise that confers a benefit. The court then inquires, is there evidence in the statute itself or in the circumstances under which the contract, that the statute was enacted, that manifests that the legislature intended this to be a contractual promise? That's the analysis that we think has to be done. To date, I haven't seen that analysis done by the PERS Coalition, and it certainly isn't contained in the opinion of Legislative Council. If you go through that analysis, and with respect to the provisions of 2004 and 2003, then I think that there's a very good case that can be made for the fact that every one of the changes is permissible and does not either breach or impair contractual obligations. I've spoken to you already about mortality tables, and the difficulty with the PERS Coalition's position on mortality tables is they have yet ever to point to a statute that promises in any way that the PERS board will use outdated mortality tables to calculate benefits. Similarly, with respect to House Bill 2003, if you talk about the elimination of the requirement that employees contribute 6% of their income to the retirement plan, there is, of course, a statute that requires employees to do so, but the question is, did the legislature intend that to be a promise to members that they would always be required to contribute 6% of their income to the retirement plan? Because what House Bill 2003 does is simply transfer 100% of the responsibility for funding the plan to employers. And it is not at least intuitively obvious that The legislature intended to make a promise to employees that they would always be required to contribute 6%, or that there is any breach of a contractual promise by requiring now employers to pick up 100% of the cost. The other area that legislative council commented about is the Lipscomb decision, and I want to make just two comments concerning what legislative council had to say about Judge Lipscomb's decision. First of all, he said that the Section 26 of the bill adjustment, the so-called Lipscomb adjustment, which, as you will recall, provides for paying the cost of the errors identified by Judge Lipscomb out of future earnings, would be a breach of contract in his view because it would require Tier 2 members to pay for the cost of errors that accrued to the benefit of Tier 1 members. Now, as a technical matter, that's not 100% true. Some of the errors that were identified by Judge Lipscomb, at least in theory, accrued both to the benefit of Tier 1 and to Tier 2 members. But as I've testified before, it is true that the effect of the adjustment is to require those people who are earlier in their career and will be in the system longer before retirement to bear a greater burden of reduced future income crediting than more senior members who are closer to retirement. And I have acknowledged and will again acknowledge that that's a legitimate policy question for this committee to wrestle with as to whether that is the fair and right way to pay for the cost of the errors identified by the court. And in a series of conversations that we've been having, we've been looking for ways to try to more finely tune the impact of the adjustment. It's a difficult challenge, particularly in light of the guidelines that the governor's provided us that says that you can't take money out of retirees' benefits and you can't take money out of current members' account balances. It leaves us with very few options. But to say that there's a legitimate question about whether that's the right thing to do or exactly how you do it is not to say that it is a breach of contract if you do it. In order for it to be a breach of contract as to Tier 2 members, one would have to be able to point to a statute that says that Tier 2 members have a right to receive 100% of the investment income attributable to their account. And there is no such statute. It doesn't exist. And so the basic premise of legislative counsel's conclusion that the Lipscomb adjustment is itself a breach of contract just is false. The second thing I want to say to you about the comments that legislative counsel made with regard to the Lipscomb decision, and I think this responds in part to a question that Representative Nolan asked me the last time I was here, is that he cautioned you that Judge Lipscomb's decision may not be correct. It may not be upheld on appeal. And I acknowledge that it may not be upheld on appeal. I feel strongly that the judge got it right, and Mr. Hartman feels strongly that the judge got it wrong, and everybody's got a nose on that issue. But ultimately, the appellate court's going to tell us. But the real question is, what is the impact of adopting a remedy to the decision today if it turns out that Judge Lipscomb got it wrong? And what I would say to you is that we would not be in any worse position in the event that you adopted House Bill 2003, the remedy for the Lipscomb decision. And the Supreme Court ultimately said that Judge Lipscomb in one or more ways was incorrect. The worst that can happen is we're back to the status quo. On the other hand, if you adopt House Bill 2003's remedy, and that is reviewed simultaneously, as we believe it should be, with the underlying decision of Judge Lipscomb, then the court has before it both the problem identified by Judge Lipscomb and the solution crafted by this body. And it allows the court to deal with this issue one time and be done with it. And it allows us to begin the process of implementing, correcting the errors identified by Judge Lipscomb sooner rather than later. Because in an environment where there are something like 40,000 PERS members eligible to retire, every day that goes by is costing the taxpayers money and contributing to ongoing uncertainty on the part of PERS members as to where they stand. So we believe that it is in definitely in the public interest to act now and not await a final decision on the appeal. And I don't think that, contrary to what legislative counsel suggests, that doing so subjects the state to any financial risk whatsoever. So those are my comments. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions? Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Geary, I thought I heard between the lines in your comment that the only way for the state to enter into a contract is through statute or action of the legislature. Is that a fair interpretation of what you said?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, the legislature can, in instances, delegate to agencies the power to enter into contracts in the normal course of business, of course, and it has done so. In the context of the public employees retirement system, the only decisions, the only court decisions that have found contractual rights are contractual rights created by the legislature in enacting statutes. Said another way, it is the legislature that defines the program through the enactment of the statutes, and the job of the Public Employees Retirement Board is simply to administer that program and to calculate the benefits that are provided by statute. It is, so that's the context in which I intended to say that only the legislature makes the contractual promises. In the context that we're dealing here, I think that's true.
A quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
I want to be really clear. What I heard you just say is that the courts have only found contractual rights in actions of the legislature. That is not the same as saying that the courts have found other actions lack the force of contract and no other mechanism can create a contractual right. And I don't think the courts have said that latter part. Am I right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, you are correct that in the context of the public employees retirement system, there is no case that holds that the Public Employees Retirement Board does not have the power to create contractual obligations on the part of the state. No case has held that because no case has ever been presented to the court in which that argument has been made. In fact, that argument has not been made in the pending litigation. That argument has never been presented to the Public Employees Retirement Board, to my knowledge. The Attorney General has advised the Public Employees Retirement Board that it does not have the power to make contractual promises to PERS members. And there's a very long line of judicial decisions, starting with a case called Harsh Investment, which I'll be happy to provide you the citation to, which hold that members who deal with state agencies and rely upon promises that are made by state agencies that go beyond the statutory authority of the agency, those people do not have any right through either contract or promissory estoppel or any other legal theory to enforce the promises that have been made by the agency in derogation of the statutes. And so while there is no case that specifically holds it, I think that with the single exception of legislative counsel, it is generally assumed, and I believe assumed by the PERS Coalition, that the PERS Board lacks the authority to make contractual promises that are enforceable.
Not so much a question, Mr. Chair, but I think that's the nut of the question, though, and that is whether actions taken by the Board were in derogation of the statutes or actually implemented the statutes, and the statutes made policy decisions or at least let stand policy decisions that in retrospect may not have been very wise.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I think that one can phrase the question that way, and I'm comfortable with it being phrased that way. If the issue is, as legislative counsel suggests, if if a promise was made, such as in the context of mortality tables, a promise by the board that they would use outdated mortality tables, as legislative council frames it, then the question is, did the legislature delegate to the PERS board the authority to make that commitment? And one way to look at that is to examine, again, the statutes to see if there's any evidence in the statutes that the legislature intended to empower the PERS board to increase benefits beyond those provided by statutes through a mechanism such as the use of outdated mortality tables. Now, legislative counsel says that that's the question. A little bit surprisingly to me, he doesn't answer the question, because it seems to me that the answer is obvious if you're familiar with the provisions of the PERS statutes, that the legislature never had that intent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the 6% thing, I'm a little bit lost there. I mean, I can see an argument about mortality tables being kind of updated, but I was in PERS briefly back in the early 70s, never vested, so I'm not in that. But I've kind of stayed familiar with pension issues over the years, and I have never heard where anybody would ever concede to you that the employee 6% would not be paid in as part of that account. So I'm wondering about you saying there's no contract there. I mean, there's years and years of history there. I don't know how we can just say, we don't think that counts anymore, and change that without really crossing the line there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, you're right, in the sense that this has been a part of the structure of PERS for a long time. And in that sense, I think the idea of eliminating the requirement of the employee contribution is an outside-the-box kind of an idea. I would acknowledge that. And it's also a little bit counterintuitive, as I've said before, because you would think that eliminating the requirement that employees contribute 6% would mean that the cost to the employer would go up. And, in fact, it does not. But I would submit that that's a separate question from the question of whether, when the legislature set up PERS and required equal, or what at the time were anticipated would be equal contributions by employers and employees, that was a contractual promise that the PERS members would always be required to make that contribution. You don't typically think about a contractual promise coming in the form of a requirement that a member do something. Usually the contractual promise is, if you do something, then I will give you some benefit. And what House Bill 2003 says is, we're no longer going to require you to do something, and we will continue to give you the benefit. Now, the effect of eliminating the employee contribution is that over time it diminishes the impact of the money match benefit. And that's why it saves money. And so the argument that it breaches a contract right to eliminate the employee contribution has to be based on the fact that the money match itself is a contract right. And I know that some people, including Mr. Hartman, expressed great surprise when I suggested that the legislature never intended to make a contract promise to PERS members that they would receive the money match benefit. But I submit to you that anyone who looks at the legislative history is forced to come to that conclusion. It is crystal clear in the legislative history. And because of that, and because that's really the only way that benefits are affected by the existence of an employee contribution, we don't think that there's any contract problem with eliminating the required contribution. I would add to that that although the OSPOA case that's discussed by legislative counsel, and you've heard about the Measure 8 case, does contain language that suggests that there's a problem with changing benefits on a prospective basis. I think that's the most vulnerable aspect of that decision. And the effect of eliminating the employee contribution is that it freezes the accrued benefits of members. You don't have to have an argument about what the accrued benefit is. The accrued benefit is whatever the member has in their account and what they're entitled to. And so the effect of eliminating the contribution is prospective only. And we have a high degree of confidence that, presented with the question of whether you can make a change of that kind on a prospective basis, protecting the accrued benefits of members, that the court is going to say that that's permissible.
For existing employees.
For existing employees.
So, same perspective, but if I worked here a number of years in PERS, and I believe my account and what I've been told, here's how this is going to work, and then all of a sudden you say, well, from now on it's not going to work that way. And that's what, as I understand, that's what the PERS Coalition is saying. You're crossing the line there and breaching the contract. Is that correct?
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I think that is the argument that they're making. That what they're saying is that on day one, when an employee begins work, if the promise is that, you know, everything that is in the statute, then anything you do that changes the statutes, unless it has the effect of increasing projected future benefits, is a breach of contract. No court's ever said that. No Oregon court has ever said that. If that's the law, then we better find that out, because there isn't anything that you can do that will have any meaningful effect on the cost of the system. We don't believe that the court is going to reach that conclusion, but I have to acknowledge to you that that's a legitimate disagreement, and that's what needs to be discovered.
Thank you. If I may ask your opinion on something, without, I don't want to really nail you down this, but it's my contention, let me set that up first, that these things are going to be challenged. We know they are. So I think any savings we have while this is going on, if we make a change, it's going to create a savings. We need to escrow that money until the court comes back. And some of my colleagues have suggested that would be a bad idea, because it might then appear that we think we have a weak case. That isn't my perception. And I just think it would be fiscally prudent, having watched and reading Oregonian over the last however many years, of seeing the legislature make a change, have a court overturn it, and then they owe a huge chunk of money they've got to come up with from somewhere else. But it makes sense to you to escrow money on any first changes until we get a court decision? Is that, or do you think that's necessary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I'm a little bit leery about weighing into the budget debate, but I will tell you this. I think that there will be a challenge to anything that you do that saves money, and it would be prudent not to tie your horse to that decision until it has been upheld. That's the reason why why House Bill 2003 provides for an expedited method of getting this to the Supreme Court. I think it needs to be done as quickly as humanly possible. Whether you escrow the money or not, I'm asked by my clients, local governments, all the time about what to do about rate increases. And one comment that I would offer is that under the best of circumstances, any savings that you realize by any reforms that you currently have before you are a little bit ephemeral, in that, you know, you just heard recently a report that the projected deficit is somewhere north of $16 billion, and so that, you know, we're not going to be out of the woods even if you pass House Bill 2003 and 2004 and any other good proposal that comes before you. And I think that in spending money, it's probably wise to keep that in mind.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for accommodating my schedule.
You're welcome. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2003? Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2003. Open public hearings on House Bill 2008, House Bill 2020, and House Bill 3169. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll come around front if you would allow me to do so.
You may.
Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, this is not a cruel April Fool's joke that finds me in front of you. I am, for the record, looking at Greg McPherson, and I'm coming around to this side of the dais to present a proposal for trying to, for the successor plan design, it's a design that I've been working on for some time. It draws on my experience as an employee benefits lawyer. I've worked on pension plans of a number of employers, mainly private employers within the state over many years. I've spent the last 25 years before I came to serve in this building working on the employee benefit arrangements of a number of employers, large, medium, and small within our state, and that gives me a perspective that some other, most other members of the body don't have. And it's really drawing on that experience that I'm offering up a proposal for the successor plan. I came with a lot of experience with respect to pensions, but not really a lot of experience interacting with the PERS system. And I've learned a lot about it along with you. And what I've learned in that process is that the system we have now, it really needs to be replaced. Tinkering is not going to be sufficient to fix the system. And for new hires, we need a new retirement plan. And so that's what I brought to you today. And there's an outline of it. I call it the Oregon Retirement Plan for Public Employees. Consisting of a couple of pieces. They're called the pension program and the individual account program. I designed this program drawing on input from various sources, from my experience working in the field, on the information that we got from...
don't blame me. Aliens.
Can you try talking in that microphone?
Okay, does that work better?
Oh, yeah.
All right, okay.
Excellent, thank you.
I'll spare you a repeat of what I just said. This is a proposal that draws on my experience, on the good work that has been done by the employer group and the employee group that has been meeting and brought a consensus on many points. To this committee. It takes those ideas, incorporates most of them, and then moves forward to a package that I think is coherent and works as a package. It's based on what I think is good public policy and the an Oregon tradition of seeking nonpartisan best solutions to really intractable problems that we face here today. The new Oregon Retirement Plan for public employees is a balanced result. It won't make everybody happy, but I think it does bring together elements that we have heard expressed by a variety of people. I developed it in cooperation with the governor's staff, and I understand that the governor is supportive of this proposal. I think one thing to sort of take as a sort of starting point is to frame what it is we're trying to accomplish here. This is not going to solve the problems of funding within the current PERS system, because this is a plan that will apply to new hires, people hired after July 1, 2003. It's for the next generation of public employees in Oregon, and is really designed to provide what they need as an appropriate incentive to come and perform the important public services that we depend on them for. Even if we eliminated a retirement program entirely, we wouldn't solve the funding issues that exist with respect to the current system. So we're not going to do anything more than have a more modest impact on the existing costs we have. But this, in my view, is an opportunity to learn from the experience in the past and the things that happened wrong within the current PERS system and to get it right with respect to a program going forward. Any retirement plan, in my view, drawing on my experience working in the field, should provide an adequate retirement income for employees. That income should be reliable, and it must be affordable by the employer. So those are the standards that we need to be looking to when we're designing a system like this. And it's with those in mind that I developed this proposal. As I mentioned before, it combines a pension program with an individual account program, or another way to express it using typical terminology in this field is defined benefit, that's the pension side, and defined contribution, which is the individual account program. The pension program is paid for entirely by the employer, and it would provide a lifetime income payable per month, as the PERS system does currently to retirees. And that would be based on a formula which is 1.5% of final average salary per year of service for general service employees and 1.8% per year of service for police and fire employees. And in that respect, it maintains the same increment provided for public safety that is in the current system, which is under its full formula variation, is 1.67% and 2.0%. That benefit would become vested after 5 years of service. It would be 0% vested until 5 years of service has been performed. So somebody who comes in and out of the system for just a few years without getting to 5 years of service would forfeit any right under this defined benefit pension program. It has retirement ages that are higher than what is in the PERS system now. And that is, I think, really accomplishes two things. One is that it does reduce the cost of the program from what it would otherwise be. It also reflects the fact that this is the next generation of public employees. These are the people who will be commencing work after July 1 of 2003 and will be working for us, we hope, for the next 20 or 30 years. And we've seen advances in longevity. We've seen that people are, because they understand better how to take care of themselves, people are vigorous and healthy to a later age. So it is reasonable to expect that they will work longer in the future before they're at a point where they need to retire. And that's a reality that spreads through other aspects of retirement. For example, the Social Security system started out with an age 65 retirement age, that full benefits available at 65, and that age has been moved from 65 to 67. It's going in stages, but it reflects that same reality. The annuity benefit, the lifetime benefit being delivered out of that plan, would include a cost of living adjustment post-retirement that is the lesser of actual CPI or 2% per year. it would not include disability benefits until the age of retirement. That is, there would be accrual of benefits. That is, a worker would earn a benefit while disabled if they become disabled earlier in their career, and then that would apply toward the formula at retirement age. But in that period between the point of disability and retirement age, this retirement plan would not pay them anything. They would be building up rights under it, and that is consistent with what is the most common practice among retirement plans in the private sector, for example. That means, of course, that the disability benefit needs to be delivered from another source, because employees need to be covered by a disability benefit, and there should be such a benefit. It's just that this is designed as a retirement plan, not as a disability plan. And I anticipate there will be some separate vehicle that would create a state-administered disability program that would be available to our public employees and would be appropriately priced for local government employers to participate in it. But the concept here is to have a program that is a retirement program that costs what it takes to deliver a retirement benefit, not a disability benefit. It similarly would not include retiree health benefits, because that's, again, not a pension system or retirement system. And it's partly the addition of those features, disability, health benefits, very early retirement benefits, unreduced. It's a combination of a whole range of features that have caused the existing PERS system to become as expensive as it has become. Now, what does this cost? Well, the average cost across the
the entire population of public employees has been analyzed by Mark Johnson, the PERS actuary, and that cost is 8.08% of payroll. That's the normal cost. Now, understand that that's not what employers will be paying if we implement this along with the continuation of the existing PERS system for current members, because there's a lot of cost already built into the system that has to be paid off over time. But that's what it would cost over the long pull if this is the only program we had for public employees, is 8.08% of payroll across the entire population. So a little bit less than that for general service, somewhat more than that for police and fire. That is as compared with 9.72% as the normal cost for Tier 2. So it is a significant savings from the program that is in place now from the standpoint of the employer. Over a full working career of 30 years for a general service employee and 25 years for a public safety employee, then the resulting pension would be 45% of final average salary. So nearly half of the individual's pre-retirement income would be replaced by the pension part of the program, entirely paid for by the employer. And in that respect is quite consistent with what larger private sector employers deliver to their employees in my experience as a practitioner in the field. Then in addition to the pension program, there would be an individual account program, or think also the term defined contribution. And into that individual account program, each member's account, the existing 6% member contribution would go, and it would go either on a picked-up basis by the employer, if that's the deal that has been struck through collective bargaining or otherwise between the employer and the employer bargaining unit, or it would be an after-tax contribution paid by the member without any tax benefit. So this connects with existing bargaining agreements without having to reopen them, as has been proposed under some of the bills that are before us. That member contribution would accumulate in an account where it would be, the 6% would be fully vested. That is, it's the employee's money, so there's no reason to have a vesting schedule for it or have it forfeited. So there'd be something for the short-term employee. They would be assured of having that 6% build up, and they would get that 6% if they left the system at any point down the road. So there's a balance here between an incentive for long service provided by the pension program and for shorter service provided by the individual account program. There is the opportunity under the program for employers to contribute something in addition to the 6% member contribution. So if it fit into the total package of incentives that the employer wanted to provide or what was negotiated for at the bargaining table, there would be then also an employer contribution, and that contribution would be subject to the same 5 years of service vesting schedule that applies under the defined benefit program. So if the individual left before 5 years of service, they would forfeit that. But if they stayed beyond 5 years, it would be theirs. This individual account program could accept rollovers. Those are tax-free transfers from other retirement systems that the employee may be covered by, so that the employee can bring those dollars over in a portability kind of mechanism. That is, the ability to bring your accumulated retirement along with you when you move from one position to another. If the member terminated before retirement age, the account would be distributable. If vested, it would be the entire account could be rolled over to an individual retirement account. It could be taken into income and tax paid on it, whatever the member chose. This individual account program would be invested by the Oregon Investment Council. And I think that's a significant part of this proposal. I think it's important when we look at to reform the PERS system that we not change the parts of it that are working well. And the investment side of the PERS system has been working just fine. In fact, it has been very very creatively invested. The people who oversee the investment side of this program are sophisticated people who took the opportunity to get into less traditional kinds of investments at times in the past, which yielded very strong returns. I remember early in my career, I worked on the going private transaction of the Fred Meyer stores back in the early 1980s. And a key investor in that project was the Public Employee Retirement System of the state of Oregon, and the fund made a lot of money on that transaction. It worked out very well, and it's that kind of creativity that has caused the Oregon Investment Council to be recognized on a national basis as being very effective at the managing of retirement dollars. And part of this program is to have the individual account program then part of that system, so that we don't have members having to try to direct their own investments among a range of confusing options, but rather bring them professional investment management. That individual account program then also generates a retirement income, which combined with the 45% of pay for a full career worker then is a significant retirement income. If you for police and fire, you add the 19% of final average salary that would be replaced after 25 years to the 45%, and you get a 64% replacement ratio. For general service employees who would have more because they're accumulating over five more years, that's a 28% replacement for them, which gets that up to 73% of final average salary. So it, in combination between the two sides, produces a quite adequate retirement income that is an appropriate commitment to the people who undertake public service for us. Well, I've been running on now at quite some length, so I'll take a break here and see if there are any questions.
Questions, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, I have several questions, actually. It says lifelong monthly payments equal to percentage of final average salary. You didn't define the final average salary. What would that be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, yes, and this outline doesn't go into a lot of details that will be in the amendment language, and I should have explained that this is in the process of drafting and has been for some time, with drafts going back and forth between legislative counsel and me to reflect what we think the system should look like. Because we're designing an entirely new retirement system, that is necessarily taking quite a bit of time. But one of the details that will be in the bill is what final average salary is, and it is essentially a base pay definition. That is, it is base salary or wages, not including overtime, not including unused sick leave or payment of accumulated vacation. The idea being that it's the income level that a member was accustomed to living on as the benefit they could, or the pay they could count on before retirement, that should be the baseline that we're trying to replace a certain proportion of, not those variations that tend to swing up or down.
But at the present time, like PERS is 30 average of over 36 months. I know of other plans that are average over 60 months. According to an average of the last 12 months.
This would use the same averaging rule, Representative Barker, as the current PERS system does, which is the highest 3 years. Although I believe, and I'll look over my shoulder at Mr. Voitko, the executive director, I believe that the PERS system now does not require that those years be consecutive. Under the full formula benefit, and this definition would require that they be the three consecutive years, and it's either that or the last 36 months of employment, which for most people is their highest 36, is the last 36.
Okay, if I may follow up, when you talk about the disability stopping, so if somebody works 10 years and is disabled, they wouldn't receive a benefit until they retired. They would just receive a benefit based on the actual 10 years they worked and not on 10 years plus any other thing? Or?
Chair Cano, Representative Barker, no, they would accrue a benefit. They would earn a benefit while they were disabled that then it commences to be paid at retirement age. So if somebody worked for 10 years, say, as a general service employee, so they had then 15% of their final average salary earned by that point. If they then became disabled and remained disabled for another 20 years, they would then keep earning increments to that so that they would get up to the same 45% of final average salary.
And what would that final average salary be, though?
Chair Canope, Representative Barker, it would... it depends under our draft amendment language at this point. It would depend on whether it was a service-connected disability or not. If it was service-connected, that is, they became disabled because of something that happened to them in the line of duty, then it would the pay level, the final average salary, would increase to the so it keeps pace with what a comparable position, this position they were in when they became disabled, or a comparable position would move to. But if it was not service connected, so for example, if they had an automobile accident going down the freeway, something unrelated to employment, then it would not increase with their final average salary.
Okay, thank you. And if I may follow up on the replacement rates at 45% of average salary, that is, it's not capped at that, or is it?
It is not capped at that, so that if a member chose to work beyond 30 years, then they would continue to accrue that additional benefit. So that, for example, if a general service member worked for 40 years, they could get to a 60% pension out of the pension program. And I think that's consistent with the objective that I was describing earlier, that we need to build in inducements to our public employees to continue providing service to us for as long as they're ready, willing, and able to do that. And if they want to keep working, they should be able to be earning something further toward their retirement.
Thank you. If I may, on that, just briefly, I looked at things like these and teachers who are traditionally longer term, you start young and stay there. So most of those would, a firefighter starting at 19, retiring at 55, the earliest age they could, would be 64.8 is what I have. And the general service starting at 18, working until 60, would be 63. So those would be, I mean, first looking at these 45 look pretty low, but in looking at the long term, people would actually have an increased benefit.
There would be continuing inducement to people to work to a until they're ready to retire.
Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relative to the Representative McPherson, relative to the issues that we have right now for retirees, the 1,039 hours, envision what may happen there, where we're trying to encourage the employees to continue to work to have a larger vested portion of the retirement. Do you anticipate that you would take away a portion of their retirement if they decided to work afterwards?
Chair Cano, Representative Butler, this proposal would not take away any benefit from people who continue to work, and that's consistent with the current PERS system. That is, an individual who continues to work would be getting their current paycheck, and they wouldn't get any less retirement by continuing to work. But it would have the same rule under which those who work more than 1,040 hours in a year would not be able to retire and then come back to work and draw both their current pay and their retirement income.
Follow-up, additional question.
Follow-up.
In private plans, do we normally see these 2% COLAs like we have presently in the PERS? I know that you provided for that in this current system. And is the cost of the system rolled into the 8.08 payroll cost?
I'll answer the second question first. At Chair Canope, Representative Butler, the cost of the COLA is part of the 8.08% of payroll costing on this design. cost of living adjustment is very common in public employee plans across the country. It has become increasingly unusual among private plans. The clients that I work with that are private sector defined benefit plans that formerly had cost of living adjustments have all dropped them. So I'd say there's a trend away from cost of living adjustments in the private sector, but that trend has not reached the public sector. It's most common when you look at the plans across the country to have a COLA adjustment.
Additional questions?
Follow up?
Everything McPherson, the employer is sort of provide this outside health benefit or this outside disability benefit. Have you anticipated how much it might cost and how that cost would be borne?
Chair Canoe, Representative Butler, this set of amendments that I'll be bringing forward to House Bill 2008 anticipates that there will be another vehicle that will provide a disability benefit available, particularly to our public safety employees, because they put themselves in harm's way, and it's, I think, an important part of the commitment we make to them that if they're going to endanger themselves as they do, that we take care of them when they are stricken down. And so it's important that we have that kind of vehicle. We have not tried to build it into this set of amendments to House Bill 2008 because what we need to design here initially is a retirement program. This is a retirement plan, and I think we need to take into account the considerations that affect that. And a disability plan is something different. I think it's an important part of a benefit package, and I think it's important that we develop it. It's just that it should be costed separately. And I've had some input from discussions with local government employers that they have available to them insurance arrangements that they believe will deal effectively with that need without going into a statewide pool as has been provided by the PERS system. So the aim here is to have a retirement plan that operates for pension and individual account benefits and have a disability program that we would design separately. And I would be pleased to work with members of the committee to develop what that program would look like.
Follow up in that regard.
Follow up.
But presently, if someone is cut down in employment and they're a state employee, aren't they covered by state action industrial funds?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, I believe that's the case. I believe that that workers' compensation delivered through the SAFE agency is provided to public employees, although you're now getting a little further afield than my expertise, so I'm not sure just what, you know, how workers' compensation fits together with the disability benefit that's provided under PERS and other disability coverage that may be provided by governmental employers.
If I could explain, Mr. Chair, my concern was, which you'd mentioned earlier, that those employees that might be damaged or hurt in a car accident, as opposed now that these that are hurt on the job. And my concern is as to how many of the stakeholders have had input into the separate costing for the actual workers' compensation benefit or the disability benefit, and that's a significant cost, I would think.
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, the focus of discussion at this point has been on the retirement provisions, and I would say there's a lot more work that needs to be done on the disability benefit piece, and that's a piece, as I say, that needs attention because we don't want to leave our people going bare without a disability benefit. But how it's costed and how that cost is allocated as among public employers, those are issues that I think need to be addressed as yet.
Segway question, Mr. Chair.
Segway question.
If we're not going to leave them bare, then why in the devil aren't we providing them any benefits as to health insurance?
The Chair Canope, Representative Butler, the reference here is to retiree health benefits. They're of course are regular ongoing health benefits for active employees that are delivered now outside the PERS system. So that's not been part of PERS at any point. What is part of the PERS system now are retiree health benefits that provide coverage to individuals who retire, particularly, I believe, those who retire before Medicare eligibility age. And that is another area where there's something that's not strictly a retirement benefit that the system we call PERS has been asked to deliver. And I think that our understanding of what is needed and our implementation of a new system will go better if we take the each of these pieces in bite-sized chunks. And I think that designing a retirement program for new hires is the first order of business among this package. But I think there clearly needs to be a disability benefit. I think that retiree health benefits is that's something that needs yet further discussion. Those are benefits that have become very expensive in recent years. I know from my experience working with a range of clientele that retiree health benefits have been scaled back to a great extent by employers because of the extraordinary cost they present, and I think that's part of the discussion that needs to go on.
Mr. Chair, one question relative to the individual account program. The employer contributions up to the 5 years in the individual account program would not be vested.
Right.
So if an employee has worked at three different public employers over a period of 5 years, some of whom have been contributing employers and some of whom have not been bargained for that benefit, does that create any kind of a bookkeeping issue in your mind, Representative?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler. That's a very good question, and the issue you're raising is one of those details that actually I had not framed in my own mind as yet, and that is what you're describing is a situation where a member works for several different governmental employers but doesn't stay in total with the group of them for 5 years of service. So forfeits their benefit. And one point to note for the rest of the committee is that means that they are accumulating service at all three employers toward the 5 years because it's a uniform system. But if they fall short of the 5 years, the question is what happens to that forfeited account that the employer contributed? And the general expectation is that the forfeiture would apply as an offset against that employer's contributions so that the employer from whom the forfeiture occurred would get the benefit of the forfeiture as a cost offset. And the question then would be whether you trace the forfeiture back to each of the employers that made each contribution, or whether you apply that forfeiture to the last employer's costs. And I have to say that you have penetrated to a level of detail, Representative Butler, that I hadn't yet gotten to in my own thinking.
You're getting there, though. I appreciate it. I have two global questions, if I could. Mr.
Global question.
Global question. Number one global question. Do you envision that the current PERS system, which is an ongoing system to continue to manage tiers 1 and 2, would be the manager of the new PERS, I guess it's the Oregon Retirement Plan for Public Employees?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, I do. We have a PERS agency in place that handles the administration of a current system, and it's an extremely complicated system, and I think they do a remarkably good job at dealing with the complexities that have been put into that system over many years by people in this building. And I think we ought to draw on the structure and expertise that they've built up to administer this system. It would be overseen by the Public Employees Retirement Board, which under House Bill 2005, passed by the House and awaiting action in the Senate, would become a five-member board, and they would oversee this plan.
Just a final question then.
Is this a global?
Second of the
global or segue?
This is the second global question.
Okay.
Final question. You'd indicated that the governor's staff has been at the table. Who are the other stakeholders that have been at the table while you've been sorting this through, Representative Kirsten?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, this proposal has been described to the selected members of the PERS coalition through an arrangement by the governor's staff, and to a gathering of the local government employers, at which meeting there were several representatives of the business community as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, the individual account program would be optional or mandatory?
Chair Canope, Representative Brown, the individual account program would be mandatory for all employers who are in the PERS system now. And that's a point I maybe should have emphasized earlier on. In fact, both sides of this plan would be mandatory for existing employers. There's no option or opportunity for existing PERS employers to leave the system with the implementation of this plan. And the pension program would be fixed in statute so that the same provisions would apply uniformly across the entire population of public employees. That uniformity is for both to assure that the commitment that we make to a public employees of a reliable and adequate retirement is met, and it's also for administrative ease so that we don't have individual employers striking special deals to, you know, vary the retirement age or alter the multiplier formula or a host of other kinds of issues that might be altered. However, on the individual account program, the contribution level would be at the 6% initially, but that 6% could vary depending on what was provided by the employer in the case of non-bargaining employees or bargained at the bargaining table as between represented employees and their employer. And that's because we don't have the same need of uniformity. The individual account program works fine even if you had employer A at 6% of pay and you had employer B negotiate to 4% of pay or up to 8% of pay, that is 6% plus 2% more from the employer. So that same need for uniformity doesn't exist there, and one of the themes that that I heard from the employers is the need to have some greater flexibility than the current PERS system allows them.
The 64% and 73% replacement rates, how does that compare with private industry?
Chair Canope, Representative Brown, a typical larger private employer would have a defined benefit plan, which would have a similar level of pay replacement for a full career employee as this pension program does, and would have a 401k plan and under which the employee can reduce their pay by a certain amount individually. They can make an individual election with some degree of matching from the employer. I suppose the appropriate comparison is between a combination of the pension program and whatever is in that 401k plan, both employer match and employee salary reduction contribution, and that would be highly variable individual by individual. But for an employee who did a typical level, this is probably similar or maybe a little on the high side of what would happen. And I don't have any statistics to back that up. I'm just going on kind of a gut feel from my experience as a practitioner. But I think that a total pay replacement between the 401k side and the pension side for a larger private sector employer would I think oftentimes be in the 60 to 70% of pay range that this is in.
The acronym now for the Public Employees Retirement System is PERS. the acronym for the Oregon retirement plan to be TORPE.
actually got added to, Representative Brown, the beginning got added in the last minute editing without my seeing it, so it was the Oregon retirement plan was without the T was what I had in mind, but if you like TORPE, I suppose we could run with that.
All right, thank you.
Along the lines of the 6%, it's a mandatory contribution, and the grave concern I have is that we have in this current plan an unfunded liability. Everybody, $16.4 billion was announced last Thursday, so ever increasing. And then we have, because of that, we have employer rates, which most employers are being stressed to the limits right now. Those rates skyrocket in July of this year. And my concern, I guess, about the mandatory nature of this is that I'm pretty confident that the employees and their representatives will say that this needs to be picked up to 6%. And so it would take the plan from, general service from 7.61 to 13.6, and for police and fire from 11.03 to 17.03, which would get us about a little lower than where rates are right now. So I guess my concern is how is this affordable and sustainable as presented, if that scenario happens?
Chair Cano, as I said earlier, anything we do on the successor plan in the shorter term, and by that I mean the next couple of biennia, will not have a material impact on employer contribution rates. This is a cheaper system than Tier 2 is, so this will be reducing employer contribution rates somewhat, but the impact is pretty gradual. So this is not a place to be looking to see what kind of savings we're going to get for the nearer term. With respect to the contribution rates, I think the key question is, who's paying the member contribution? And if the assumption is that when it's picked up, it's really being paid for by the employer and not by the employee, that is, the employee hasn't really given up something in exchange for it, then the analysis you're going through of saying, well, this is a blended across the entire population is a 14% of pay plan, 8% from the employer and 6% from the member. If you assume that member contribution is really being paid by the employer, then we've got a 14% of pay plan, and that will help to make more affordable the contribution rates that we've got over time, because it's less than what Tier 2 costs, but it's not going to have a big impact. But I think that the premise is, if your question is that about who is really paying the picked up contribution, my view of this is that is a member contribution, and if we don't provide it in a retirement benefit, employees will and should expect to get that 6% in some other way, because it was part of the package that was out on the bargaining table in the case of collectively bargained employees, and we can't convince them to give it up at the bargaining table at one point and then at some later point then decide, well, that really wasn't something that was theirs anyway. So I think we have to say that, respect the fact that bargaining decisions were made, even in the case of a picked-up contribution, where that was a member contribution. Now, bear in mind that we haven't set in statute that 6%, so whether that contribution is picked up and whether it stays at 6% is open to the bargaining process, so that there's an opportunity to reconfirm who's really paying that contribution. And I think that that's a significant aspect of the cost-sharing dimension of this proposal, is that there's, in effect, a renewal of that bargain each time a bargaining agreement is renewed, because that 6% could be renegotiated to something higher or something lower.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with your statement in regards to the fact that 6% was bargained, and if they're going to not put it in the PERS, I would think logically we can conclude that it is going to go back in some way, either a salary or something else. But the mandatory nature of the 6%, why not make it an option for the employee? I mean, what's the thought in the...
Chair Canope, individually available for decision by each employee.
Correct.
That could not be done under the without going into a couple of different provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. And it's because Section 401A of the tax code, which is the provision that governs both of the programs that are part of this proposed plan, it does not allow governmental employers to use Section 401K, which allows individual election. 401K plans are not available to governmental employers. And the only way you can get individual salary reduction elections by governmental employees is by using Section 457, which is available now to all public employees in the state. For employees in certain employers, Section 403B of the code. So there are a couple of other vehicles that allow individual election. If you allowed individual elections, that can be done, but I think that this design, if an employer wanted to transition to that, they could do that. That is, if they got a reading from their employees that the employees would rather have a pay increase, say they'd rather have 6% more in their pay and cash compensation, and then let the individual employees who wanted to contribute for their retirement through the 457 plan or the 403B plan, they could do that individually, so that in effect every employee would have 6% more in their pay, and then the individuals who wanted to save for retirement could do so. But that would be something that each employer could decide, or the employer and the bargaining unit at the bargaining table.
I've got a couple other questions, but I'll hold off because we've got several interested members. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, you know, as we consider these issues, there's two things we're looking at. One is the plan, how it works, and the other is the cost to the employer and benefits to the employee. They're kind of separate issues. We're talking about a defined benefit plan as far as the structure is concerned, and so I'd like to ask just a couple questions about the effect that a defined benefit plan structure has on predictability for employers. Because the one thing we don't want to do is get ourselves in a situation where a few years from now we find the employers in the same kind of quandary that they're in with this plan as they are in with PERS, even though there are some differences. And so I'm asking about such things as stock market volatility. The federal government seems to feel that by 2020 there may be as much as 15 years added on to life expectancy because of research that's taking place medically. And so if there is unforeseen extension of life, how does that affect the balance between employer risk and employee risk?
Chair Canoe, Representative Richardson, you're correct that there is a defined benefit element that is a half this program, the pension plan. The pension program is a defined benefit plan. But don't lose track of the fact that there is that a substantial portion of the plan has become a defined contribution plan. And I regard that as sharing the predictability then between employer and employee. It is true that as to the pension program, that program is predictable to the employee, therefore by assuring them of something that they can count on at retirement, so they won't become dependent on public assistance that will hit our budgets in other ways. But it is a scaled down version of what has been a rather large defined benefit plan that is now the challenge that we have in the existing PERS system. So what I see just kind of globally what's going on here is we're taking a system that has cost sharing between employer and employee, but all the predictability running in favor of the employee and the employer then at risk of what happens to contribution rates, to one in which the system has been split so that there is a portion that is a core defined benefit where it is predictable to the employee and unpredictable because of the vagaries of the stock market to the employers, but an individual account program where it's just the opposite, where we have great predictability by the employer and the employee is left with the uncertainties of what the markets might generate, but that has opportunity in it too, because if the markets are recover and become very strong, that will perform well for the employees.
A couple of things that have been said are a little bit, I think, could be a little misleading. For instance, I've looked at the numbers. You're showing that Tier 2 is at 9.72, and this would be at 8.08, but that 1.64 difference doesn't include the same benefits. Like we talked about, disability is not included here, and so if disability is 1.64 and anything else that may not be included here, then it's possible that the base portion of this could be as expensive as Tier 2 is presently. Is that not correct?
Chair Knoop, Representative Richardson, you're quite right that this is... It's not apples to apples in terms of the benefit being delivered between Tier 2 and the pension program, and that the removal of the disability benefit from the retirement system is a significant cost savings. I don't have the number on what that costs. I hesitate to throw this out, but I have the impression that it is less than 1% of payroll, so that even if you added it in with the cost of this proposal, it would still be less expensive than Tier 2. But I can't speak authoritatively about that, so I should defer to somebody else who has better command of the numbers.
You're correct. It's I think it's 0.75, and you divide that into workplace disability and non- workplace disability, and it's not quite 50-50, it's a little less than that. So, but overall, it's about 7.75%.
All right.
So, for disability.
Follow up. The concern that I have still dealing with the form is also that we have employers that come from different geography, different financial position, different goals, just different mix. And some may feel that it would be important to be able to attract younger employees who might be more interested in a better salary than a rich retirement plan. And so am I correct that the base portion of this, and this is what I'm dealing with presently, because I think the cost of the base is close enough to Tier 2 that's where I'm focusing on. Is it not correct that the defined benefit plan really does kind of favor older employees than younger ones that may come and go? As Representative Butler talked about, it's possible that a young teacher could come and teach for a couple of years and move and go to two or three places and have no benefits under this plan, and the employer has no choice as to whether or not to get better salary or better benefits, because, I mean, we have to face the fact that in every hiring situation there is an amount of money that's allocated to that that hire, your salary, retirement, medical, disability, whatever goes into it, but all is part of what it takes when you're figuring out your budget that you can afford to expend on one staff position. Is it correct that this kind of is stacked then for older more long-term employees?
Chair Knoop, Representative Richardson, actually I disagree with that characterization, although I agree with the sort of the fundamental sort of difference in incentive effect of the two different designs of plan. If you take a pension program that's a defined benefit and a defined contribution individual account program, it's quite clear that a pension plan, a formula plan, is more attractive to older workers, and it's a device for giving people an incentive, an inducement to remain in a full career of service. And people who are hired at early ages don't pay much attention to it because it's so remote from their experience. But if this were a pension program only, then that would be a flaw, and I think that is a flaw in the existing PERS system, that while it is a very generous program to our full career people who are approaching retirement age, it doesn't offer nearly so much to people who are early in their career. In this case here, we have the individual account program with 6% of pay that's fully vested, and the opportunity for employers that want to enhance that because they need to provide something more for their younger workers to add something to it, so that there's something that's there for younger workers as well. So I think one of the advantages of this design is that it has something for both groups. It has the pension program for the long-term older career worker, and it has the individual account program for the younger worker who's going to pay a lot more attention to what's happening in their account here and now.
Okay. Follow-up relating to cost. When we look at cost for a new program for these public sector employers, it's not a normal situation. They have been given the news that within a few years, the unfunded actuarial liability is going to be 26%, plus if they're doing the pickup, that puts it at 32%, and that's going to continue for 26 years. Now, depending on if we pass some bills, that may change that a little bit. But anyway, they're looking at a very substantial cost that they have to factor in their budgets for the next 26 years. And this isn't dealing with that. That's the unfunded liability. We're also dealing with times where revenue is much less than was hoped for, and funding for education is much less. I know in a family, if you don't have a lot of money and you have a huge bill that's ongoing, such as maybe it's a medical condition, and you need a new car, you may not consider a Cadillac even if you'd like to have it. You may end up having to go for a Ford or something less expensive, even though your neighbors may have Cadillacs, and you may want to have that, but the reality is you just can't afford it. Now, we're looking here at a plan that with the 6% pickup, and the majority of them are already paying that, so it's really unlikely that 6% is not going to continue to get paid by the employer. So for the sake of my observation, my comment and question, we're looking at 14% presently, and yet we've had testimony that in the private sector, we're looking at 3-5% is the contribution by the employer to a 401k, and then it'd be 3-5% from the employee, a matching plan. And so is it your feeling that, taking that into consideration, that we really can afford to start off with a base of 8.8 or 8.08 and then the 6%, which is going to end up being paid by the employer? I mean, we see what's going to happen with that, and we're 14, and it's not going to go down. It's only going to go up from there in the future. I mean, do you feel comfortable that we can afford this?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, I would disagree with the characterization if that was what you meant to imply about this plan, that it was a Cadillac plan. I think it's not. I think it's more in the Ford range of plan. And again, focus on who's paying what for these benefits. It's 8% of pay by the employer, and 6% by the member. Now, if you're assuming that member contribution is really being paid by the employer and the employees aren't giving up 6%, then that's something that the dynamic of collective bargaining can work out, and maybe it'll go away. Maybe it will be traded off for other things. But if you take as a premise that the picked up contributions necessarily are employer contributions, that's a 14% of pay plan, and that's definitely more generous than what you would find in the private sector. But at 8% of pay, which I think is the correct way to evaluate, that is within a reasonable range of payroll cost. We had Ron Parker from the Hampton Company, a forest products firm, before our committee a week or two ago. And you may recall that I asked him what was an appropriate percentage of payroll for an employer to spend on the retirement benefits for employees, and he said 7-10% of pay. So I think we're responsibly within that range. Now, in terms of affordability, it's really a question of what the markets are going to generate over time. The existing PERS system, just several years ago, 3 years ago, it was nearly 100% funded because of those very strong markets that we had through the 1990s. And then when we hit the down markets of the aughts that we've been going through here painfully so far, we've seen those costs spiral upward. Well, if the markets recover, then this is a plan that's readily affordable. And if they don't recover, if they stay down, if we continue to see declines in the markets, then any program we design will be very expensive because we're relying in the way we're designing this on a return these are based on 8% return figures, and if we saw something, even if we reduced the cost, the assumed interest rate to 6 or 7%, you'd see those costs get much higher.
Thank you.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for working so hard on this. This is enormously challenging, and it takes not only wisdom but guts to put something out for picking apart by your colleagues, and I appreciate both your wisdom and your guts in bringing this to us. I want to follow up a little bit on the discussion we've had already about the appropriate or competitive level of replacement rates, which are really the inverse of the employer cost. And you referenced Hampton Industries, which is in my question leads more toward my line of industry, which, as I hear the discussion in other committees and on our floor, Oregon is moving, and we want it to move more and more toward a knowledge economy. Do you have experience that can tell you or tell us about what kinds of replacement ratios and employer contributions the high-tech and knowledge-based employers that I would submit will be competitors for some of the same future employees that we'll be competing for? Not exclusively, but we're looking to hire university professors and teachers and researchers and administrators. We'll be going up against the high-tech businesses, and what kind of benefits in terms of pensions do they offer their employees?
Chair Canope, Representative Nolan, the high-tech industry does, by and large, does not have defined benefit plans. And the reason for that, I think, is twofold. One is that it is a younger workforce, by and large, that it has and has been building up over time, and so younger workers don't tend to favor defined benefit plans. It's not an effective inducement to them. And it's also because the nature of that industry is one where long-term commitment to one organization is not really in people's frame of thinking. They don't expect to be at their current employer for a long time, and so the idea of a pension that's based on their length of service that they perform in that with that company just isn't something they think about. They want something that's portable. They see it here and now in an account. They can measure it readily and take it with them. I see the public sector functioning much more as a counterpart to the more mature industries in our private sector. And I work with a range of companies, a regulated utility, a truck manufacturing company, several forest products companies, companies that have been doing business in Oregon for decades. And those companies, by and large, have a defined benefit plan in addition to a 401k plan. So they've got kind of the range of structures. They've got something for the older worker, they've got something for the younger worker, and the combination of the two makes it work. I would say this design is not one that I, as a practitioner, would bring forward to a company that's in the high-tech business, because it wouldn't motivate the kind of workforce they're trying to attract for just the reasons you're describing. But I think for the kind of workforce that we have enjoyed in Oregon over recent decades and hope, I think, to continue having, that is, people who are committed to public service, who like having a benefit they can that will be assured to them if they move from one public employer to another. I think this design does it at the same time that it builds in an individual account program that has something for the people who have need a short-term motivation.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I think I understand that point. What I'm trying to get at, and it's both in terms of the employer contribution, but also the appeal to the employees, this is it's a successor plan. It is for employees who have not yet been recruited to to an existing public employer in Oregon. They might be in public service in some other state, but they're not working in public service here. And one of the purposes I see in any kind of benefit plan as part of compensation is that it should attract top talent. And so I guess I'd rephrase the question. How would you assess this plan and its capacity to attract talent going forward, since it's not serving people who are already here, but it will be one of the tools that the state will use, that our school districts will use, that our cities and counties will use to try to attract and retain the best talent that Oregon can recruit?
Chair Canoe, Representative Nolan, I think the design works well for that purpose. Now, in defense of the pension component within it, it is true that until a year or two ago, that defined benefit plans weren't compelling to a lot of employees because they saw these wonderful returns in the stock markets. And if they had 401k plan accounts, they saw those zooming upward with double-digit returns year after year. And a defined benefit plan didn't look very interesting to them. But with the declines in the markets, defined benefit plans, I think, are being appreciated a lot more than they have been at times in the past for their reliability. So I think that that component still will be significant to people who are making career decisions as they see the uncertainties of the defined contribution marketplace, even though I think it's appropriate for them to have a stake in that marketplace as well. With respect to attracting top talent, I think that we're always going to have to be creative in public service about coming up with ways to bring top-flight people into our organizations. And I think there will always need to be specially crafted arrangements, quite aside from the structure of a general retirements program like this, in order to attract people of talent and energy at certain, you know, key positions in our public agencies.
Two quick questions on cost, Mr. Chair. When Mark Johnson ran these estimates, is it fair to assume that he used the 8% assumed rate on earnings?
Chair Canoe, Representative Nolan, he did use the 8% assumed return.
Okay.
Assumed interest rate.
I would submit, somewhat in keeping with the line of analysis that Representative Richardson brought forward, that as we move toward considering whether it's this proposal or some variation of the other bills we've seen, that we ask Mr. Johnson to look specifically at a period of time that mirrors 99, 2000, 2001 returns so that we can see what the effect on employer rates would be should the economy, and it's almost certain to go through another down cycle like that sometime in the next 25 years, what that will do to employer rates, because I'm betting that if we had run this out starting on January 1st, 2000, that employers would be kicking in more than 8% on this plan. If we looked back and saw losses for 3 years, the employers would have to pick that up. My point being that the structure of the plan has some impact on the employer contribution, but probably not nearly so much as the performance of the market.
Chair Canoe, Representative Nolan, on the last point, you are absolutely right. The main consideration and cost of a defined benefit pension system is what is earned on the assets that are contributed. That's absolutely right. Now, something to understand about the 8.08% is that that is the normal cost of the program. That's what it would cost over the long pole if this were the only system we had in place and we had this population in it. So that I think the an analysis of what would happen if we had been in the market at or commenced this plan at a particular point in time and then went through a particular number of years in which the investment return experience was quite different from the 8%, I think that kind of analysis wouldn't be a particularly useful analysis as compared to analyzing whether or not we think the 8% is still an appropriate assumption to make in costing any defined benefit system. And if we think that the economics of pensions have adjusted to a point where an 8% return isn't appropriate and we should be using, say, a 7% return, this structure of benefits could be analyzed for normal cost based on some different rate of return. And that could be done quite aside from whether we, in terms of our public policy decision, whether we implement this proposal without necessarily changing the assumed interest rate that is used within the PERS system. And that would be a conservative kind of thing to do. And what would happen if we were assuming, a 7% rate of return is 8.08% would become something significantly higher.
Thank you. And my point is that we tend not to have long perspectives in this building, and we react to very short-term peaks or valleys, and it would inform our decisions if we could look at a narrower window.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you. Most of my questions have been answered, but I'll ask a couple and then I'll make some comments. One of the things that I think we've been charged with by our stockholders is to reduce the financial drain that has been caused to us by the previous or the current system. In analyzing your proposal and with the assumption that the member contribution of 6% is picked up by the employer, which I think is probably a reality based upon the current contracts, I don't know that we're really accomplishing a savings to start amortizing. If we put everything into it, we're less than 0.75% differential from tier two. I don't know that that's what the folks are telling us that where they want us to be. So simply an observation that doesn't require a response. The other portion is our unfunded liability that is not being addressed, which will be an additional. And I'm also concerned that without putting some additional stops into this, that this allows future people in these seats to get us back into the same position that we are with the current PERS system that has some difficulties for me to start accepting.
Chair Canope, Representative Scott, good observation, and I think we have to be mindful of what the people of Oregon sent us here to do, which is to spend their money wisely and in this connection procure effective public services for them. I think that this is a responsible proposal in terms of spending the dollars that it takes to induce good people to come and commit themselves to perform those services. But that's something that I think people might disagree on, but open to a range of view. I'm sorry, remind me what the second point was, Representative.
Well, it was primarily with the unfunded and where we're going with that and where we would be in total costs.
Right. The Representative Scott, again, it's something to emphasize here is that we're not going to make a material impact on the costs that we have to deal with in the PERS system in whatever we do with the successor plan. If we had no retirement benefit at all promised to people who came to work after July 1, we would still have spiraling employer contribution rates. So this is really designing something that could be maintained over time. Now, I think you make a very good point when you comment on the political process by which benefits are designed, that there is a temptation on the part of legislators to, in good times, when it looks inexpensive to deliver additional retirement benefits, to promise more because it's a promise that can be made inexpensively, at least in the short term. And we clearly do need long-term thinking, going back to the comment that Representative Nolan made. There's too much short-term thinking in this building. But I think I've engaged in long-term thinking about what kind of a plan we need, and I would urge all my colleagues who continue to serve in this building that we have to maintain discipline over time so that when individuals, maybe constituents who pitch an appealing individual case and who would like to have something done to the system to make it a little bit better for their situation, to resist that temptation, because over time, the cumulative effect of that process puts things out of control. So I think the lesson learned, I hope learned, from what's happened to the existing PERS system is that we need to introduce that kind of discipline. And as long as I'm working in this body on these issues, I tell you, I'll exercise that discipline, and I will urge my colleagues to as well.
Other questions? Obviously, the defined benefit plan does leave open the possibility that should investments go bad, we could rack up an unfunded liability. And there isn't this bill, or at least the amendments, I don't see it in your key features, but there is no mechanism to control employer costs on the defined benefits side. Is that
Chair Canope? There is the cost sharing and predictability sharing feature of this proposal is in having the individual account program be a significant piece of it. And with respect to this reduced size of pension, you're right. That's an employer responsibility in contributions combined with whatever the system earns over time.
The other observation I was making as I was sitting here is you have the base of 45% final average salary, and then for police and fire it's 19% on the IAP and 28% for general services on that individual account program. And when you add Social Security to that, which is normally 25 to 35%, police and fire would be at between 89 and 99%, when they got to retirement age, recognizing that they would probably be retired earlier. And then on general service side, it would be 98% to 108% once that's calculated in. And they get to retire at either 60 or 65, depending on years of service. So that's still a pretty good benefit overall as an observation. I mean,
Can I comment on that, Chair Canope?
Sure.
I think you're absolutely right. It is a good benefit. And something I would hasten to point out, however, is that a substantial part of that good benefit has been paid for by the employees, by the members.
Half and half on as it relates to Social Security, right?
So half of the Social Security benefit is paid by the member, and under this design, the 6% contribution under the individual account program is paid for by the member. So you shouldn't take double credit for the amounts that are being delivered to the employee. If it's a member contribution and we're not trading it off with and paying them cash compensation or some other benefit, then let's give them credit on that positive side of the ledger for what they chipped in toward their own retirement.
Right, and it will be close to 50-50, I would think. Mm-hmm. When you calculate it all out, it's just trying to do the math on that as well. But I think it's an observation worth making, just because I think we need to take into account total retirement that's being provided for as it relates to employment with the state. I mean, if we weren't investing in Social Security for our employees, I don't think it would be, you know, obviously an important point. But I think since that is also a cost of payroll, I think it's an important point to make, regardless of any plan that we're going to pursue as we go forward. Representative Butler? Global?
Chair, you brought up an excellent point, and that is, this is probably a question I need to ask of Representative McPherson separately, but I do want to make certain that I understand. You're actually designing this as a 401A plan so that contributions, those separate contributions that would be made to the individual account program could be outside the scope of W-2 income, so that you're not matching the 7.65% Social Security on that thing.
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, as oftentimes you bring a penetration to an interesting detail in this program, which is that yes, by it being a 401A plan, it is not subject to spike attacks for either employer or employee. Mm-hmm. Whereas if a decision were made, I referenced earlier, where the employer and employee group decided to trade off and get cash compensation to replace the part or all of that 6% member contribution, and to allow then individuals to contribute to a 403B annuity program or a 457 plan employee by employee, those contributions would be subject to FICA.
And Representative Canope, your question brought that up. My angst is that if we're going to consider who's contributing what, then what you're trying to do is trying to protect the maximum amount of that from the 15.3% Social Security tax shared between the employer and the employee. Because really, that's paid half and half.
Any other questions? Well, let's take this to work session then. No, April Fool's.
Will the chair entertain a motion?
We don't even have amendments.
Let's just so amend it.
Conceptually.
Yeah. Let's conceptually amend our pension.
No other questions from the committee on this one? I'm going to... Representative McPherson has been in the hot seat for a while now, so I think we're going to give him a reprieve.
Okay. And a round of applause.
Yay! Good job.
And I think what we're going to do, just because of the hour at this point, is hold everything else over until Thursday and allow people to comment. Will the amendments be ready by Thursday for this particular plan?
Mr. Chair, it had been my strong desire to have amendments to distribute on Thursday. And I'd say that the pace at which Legislative Council and I are working does not make that assured.
Okay.
That'll happen. That's still my target. Certainly by the end of this week, I think can be accomplished.
Okay. We'll close the...
Chair, you have a very easy bill down here at the very bottom, 2330.
Do you have the votes for that on this committee?
Absolutely.
2330. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2008-2020-3169. 2330 was the road district bill, removes limit on number of hours retired public employees may work for a road assessment district and still receive retirement benefits under public employee retirement system. What's the? Are there any no votes in the committee on that particular bill? Yes, no?
I don't remember the bill.
Mr. Chair,
it was set up for work session today. This is the one that allows in small road districts for them to go outside the 1,039 hours. We discussed it earlier. We had a work session on it, or not a work session, public hearing on it earlier.
Mr. Chair, I would like to have an opportunity to discuss this with Representative Butler and with other members of the committee about, not because of the scope of it, about how it might relate to other employee populations that might be seeking the same kind of redress.
Yeah, but it's similar to the Harper School bill that allows in small counties the teachers or administrators and to come back on, but that'd be fine.
Let's put it back on for work session on Thursday, just so everybody has a comfort level with that bill. If there's nothing else for the good of committee, committee's adjourned.
Have you ever had anybody write a text to your committee?